ask, how many of you self-identify primarily as occupational safety and health professionals or focused? And how many self-identify as predominantly health promotion in your work? Yeah. Good. Well, actually, it's a good mix here, and one that's unusual both at this meeting and at others. I think, let me back up a couple of minutes and say that I think that there's some things that are at the foundation of what everybody said, and then I'd like to summarize some of the key points that people have made and then open it up to discussion. First, I think it goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway, employers are responsible for providing workplaces that are free of recognized hazards. That's their legal responsibility. In all this discussion of integrated programs, that's the foundation for what needs to be built upon. I think that one of the issues is what is actually recognized. For many, recognition means something for which there is a regulation. And in the absence of regulation, there's no response. And I think that part of the effort of trying to develop a mindset, a commitment to a safety culture, if you will, with worker involvement, with management commitment, is to look beyond those regulated substances and situations and say that there's a much broader work environment that has a significant impact on the health and well-being of the workforce. Second foundational element, and I think that, again, you've heard this from Ann and Bill, actually people care about the health and well-being of the workforce. It's not just that workers care, it's not just that their families care, although both the health and well-being and continued ability to participate in the workforce are important to both, but also employers more and more have come to recognize that the health and well-being, certainly of certain segments of the workforce, those that you care about attracting and retaining, that you don't want to retrain, that you don't want to deal with absenteeism, you don't want to deal with new hires, that there is interest in the employer community in trying to understand and work on programs, policies, and practices that support the health and well-being of the workforce. I think that it's also true, the health promotion community recognized this many years ago, and I think there's been a kind of traditional, not only separation, but conflict. Workplaces are a good place to deliver programs, that you have a captive audience, you have the opportunity to have access to people often who don't get a lot of involvement with the healthcare system, the sickness care system, because they're often healthy. And there are opportunities to work on programs, policies, and interventions that keep people healthy and productive. And I think ultimately what we've heard about today is that it's clear that this isn't an either-or situation, that both the work environment as well as personal choices affect the health and well-being of the workforce, and they're often very intricately intertwined. We've also heard from our presenters that there are some myths out there that I think are partial truths that are that we really need to figure out how to overcome, that come from the separation that Cassandra mentioned at the beginning of separate training, separate meetings, separate publications. We need to figure out how to get better communication among the professionals in order to take advantage of the kinds of opportunities that there are in the workplace. The kind of concept that's been really the dominant one in the health promotion community, that health is an individual responsibility, I think is, to my observation, moving, certainly among the more sophisticated health promotion folks, to understand that there is this environment individual interaction, and more of the literature is focusing on this. And it's also quite clear that for many, their health risk or their major health risk isn't a lifestyle choice. For the firefighters going into the burning restaurant in Boston who lost their lives a few weeks ago, or for the miners trapped in the collapsing mines, this isn't a lifestyle choice. This is work. This is the work environment. But in more sort of subtle or low-key ways, there are many things in the work environment, as Gloria and Laura are exploring, that have substantial impact on work and health. We've heard Ann summarize nicely the various motivators for getting employers interested in this area, healthcare costs. But it's not just employers. Again, the construction industry, the Taft-Hartley unions serve as insurers. The UAW is now, I guess, an insurance company that also represents workers in the automobile and other industries, that healthcare costs are something that are a major driver, issues of competitive pressures, productivity. There's common interest in labor and industry in worker health and well-being. An issue mentioned by, I think, and again, the aging workforce, certainly in some segments of the employer community, aging workers is a critical issue. And at the symposium that we had in Bethesda in September, this was a recurring theme, really responding to health and safety needs of an aging workforce, dealing with disparities, as Bill brought up, trying to really understand that health risk at work isn't evenly distributed throughout the working population, and that often health risk at work goes hand in hand with individual health risk behaviors, understanding that interaction, understanding if there is an opportunity, particularly with the contingent workforce, to do something about it. I think that something, again, underlying what people have said is that there's a tremendous amount of resources going into the health promotion side of this. Employers are buying programs. These motivators are really motivating people to go to vendors who are marketing programs, not necessarily science-based programs, not necessarily effective programs, but they're marketing packages. And employers, certainly the medium-sized employers who may not have in-house sophisticated staff to evaluate this or to find out what does or doesn't work, are buying these programs. And with that also comes an opportunity that I think that we need to be talking about in our conversation. So, moving the field forward, Cassandra asked that I talk about how to do that. I think, number one, we have examples here. Improve the science base. We really do need to know on the basis of intervention effectiveness research what works and what doesn't. We need to move from efficacy research where, a randomized controlled trial and a limited workforce, we need to know what's generalizable. We need to move that into multiple workforces, see what's generalizable, see what can be effective in the real world, and do adequate evaluations of the kinds of programs and policies that are being put in place. I think that we need to also understand the barriers to change. You know, this sounds wonderful. It helps employers, it helps workers, makes everybody happy, it saves money, you get return on investment. Well, you know, if it's so good, why isn't everybody doing it? And I think that this is actually a question that can be subject to research, and that we can learn what the true barriers are, and if in fact it's as good as it's promised to be, and if not, what would make it good, and what are the barriers to embracing it. I think that we also need to focus on issues of the broad work environment, work organization, go beyond specific, implementing a program to reduce cardiovascular risk, but looking more broadly at the programs, policies, and practices in a workplace, the relationships, the training, the kind of appeals process, worker engagement, and management commitment that do create the kind of culture that may have spillover effects throughout a broad area of health. We need to move from research to practice, identify, validate, and communicate the essential elements of either known effective programs or those programs and policies that appear promising. Know what works, why, and for whom, and find the right targets for this communication. I think that it's interesting, you know, we've got academics who publish in the scientific literature, but we also really have a responsibility to understand who's buying the programs and where do they go for their information. And if we know something that we think is going to be useful to improve and sustain the health and well-being of the workforce, we need to be able to get to the people within the organizations that are responsible for these areas of work. So we need to continue to build bridges, overcome these traditional barriers, and take a broader focus. I will, as Anne did, plug the Work Life Symposium website. There was actually a lot of good information that was presented at this meeting. Most of you didn't go. www.worklife2007.org or com. I think it's .com, but you ought to be able to find it by Googling it. We need to promote the value of attending to work as a useful first step in a comprehensive program for worker health. Somebody at the symposium from Europe said, it's really rang true, that dealing with work-related health problems is less sensitive and less invasive than dealing with individual behavior change. And by an enterprise showing a commitment to the overall work environment, this builds trust and engages the workforce in a willingness to move forward with their own more individualized health behavior change. Bill, in closing, said that health promotion has the ear of the CEO. I think that in the occupational safety and health community, we've seen a false belief that workplace health and safety problems have been solved, OSHA's taken care of it, there's not much more to be done, it's all within the regulatory arena. I think that those of us who have a focus on the health of the workforce rather than a specific set of rules and regulations and their enforcement really see an opportunity to build these relationships and have a greater impact by also getting the ear of the CEO, by encouraging those who are responsible for focusing on whether it's health benefits or workforce health or absenteeism control or whatever, to say, let's look at the work environment to understand those factors at work that are contributing to the problems that you're concerned about, and let's try and work on them together. And I will leave you with actually the kind of ongoing question that I have, which is, why aren't integrated programs the norm? If they're in everyone's interest, why aren't more employers embracing them? Thanks a lot for your time, and I think it's been a great panel. So thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Wagner. So now we'll take questions from the audience. We also take comments. Yes, if you have any, if you have the answer to his question, you can give it to us too. Dumbed down. I mean, it's designed to be kind of idiot-proof, that there is stickers that go on each resident's chart, and according to which sticker, this is the device you use. But I think it's maybe gone so far in that direction that there's actually not enough content being provided about why. Certainly, a lot of these employees are reporting low back pain and are reporting heavy lifting, but in terms of how the job impacts their health, they're not sort of somehow putting those two things together. So actually, I'm starting to dream up a fourth arm, if I can find the additional funding somewhere, to enhance the no lifting or the lifting reduction program with better training to go along with it, because I think that might actually be a weak link there. So you're absolutely right to point to that. About the New England networking, actually Tim Morse is sitting here. He's my main conspirator in this regard, because Tim has, as some people know already, has been convening for close to 20 years now a group of public health, occupational health surveillance folks from the various northeastern states, meaning New England, New York, and New Jersey. And we're actually working now on adding another day to that meeting in May that will bring together occupational health and chronic disease people from all of those health departments. If we can, you know, as we work on recruiting people, it looks like there's a pretty interesting, intriguingly large response to the idea of bringing people together for a day. So whether it'll be the same kind of ongoing thing, I don't know, but we are structuring a conversation to happen next May that I think will be very interdisciplinary and stimulating. And if anybody is from the Northeast and wants to know more about it, find me or Tim later.
I want to just chime in on the safe patient handling issue. Again, it's a good example of a lack of a safety culture. You know, I think they have some of it, but again, you know, dentists didn't want to wear gloves before the bloodborne pathogen standard. They said nobody would go to the dentist, and now nobody would go to the dentist if they didn't wear gloves. And so, and it's the same. Firefighters aren't going to, the co-workers, the firefighters, they're not going to let their brothers and sisters go into that to fight that fire if they're not wearing their SCBA. Yet, you know, there isn't this culture. And I would really highly recommend you read this IOM report that just came out a couple weeks ago. In fact, the final version will be on January. It's called PPE for Healthcare Workers During the Time of a Pandemic. But it talks about this lack of a safety culture in healthcare and how, you know, we need to have a culture where, you know, a healthcare worker feels uncomfortable not wearing an N95 when treating a TB patient in their room. And that currently does not exist. That culture does not exist. Employers do not discipline workers who don't use this equipment to the degree that I think they should. I'm a union person. I mean, if you come in late 3 days a week, 3 days in a row a week, they'll fire you. But if you don't wash your hands, they don't fire you. Now what is this mixed message? Do they really want you to wash your hands? Because if they did, wouldn't they discipline you if you didn't wash your hands? And I just think there's a real issue on, again, this lack of a safety culture that permeates this industry. And yes, it does take about 3 or 4 minutes longer to use a safe patient handling device. But again, the cost savings, when you look at the average back injury, that's $18,000 versus, you know, taking these extra couple of minutes. And the difficulty of replacing these low-wage workers, because they could just as easily be making as much money flipping hamburgers instead of flipping patients. And so, I would argue that it's a lack of a safety culture, and the supervisors aren't telling their workers, you know, the supervisors' wages need to be linked to, you know, there needs to be an incentive system. That supervisor does not get a raise. They get penalized during their annual review if their employees are not wearing their N95 respirators or they're not, you know, using lifting equipment every time unless they have an excuse not to use it. So.
Financial drivers in businesses. Because that can be used to leverage the decision makers in companies, their ability to free up funds for X, Y, or Z. How do you do it? There was a nice review of some of the existing products for measuring return on investment in the context of occupational safety and health done by, and I'm having a senior moment, Greg, help me out. Who was it that he did a presentation at the WorkLife 2007? He's a NIOSH researcher. Tim Bushnell.
Yeah.
Ah, came to me. Tim Bushnell, if you... I believe that research is now published, and so if you go to PubMed and look up Dr. Bushnell's name, you'll find this article. What he says is all five of the methods to put a value on health and safety programs are flawed. But he points in the direction of what could be done to improve these methods for trying to value health and safety initiatives of various sorts. So I'll just stop there, and others may have some other advice for you on how we move the field forward, as Dr. Wagner said.
I think that I think that there's a growing trend across different schools of public health and in the funding field as well to really push towards transdisciplinary training. And I think that one need here is to think about training both in occupational health and safety and in thinking about worker health behaviors within the broader context of epidemiology and planned social change, or however you want to think of it. So I think it's possible for people, for students to develop some of their own combination of courses that can really provide a cross-disciplinary base with an ability to sort of facilitate the dialogue that we're talking about here, the fact that sometimes our disciplines don't always speak the same languages, and one of the things we need to be training our students to do is to be able to have those dual languages so that there really can be more collaborative kinds of research.
Jim?
Dr. James, my turn. Programs and the
there should be a role for the government, but they haven't done that, and I'm sure there's reasons for it, but again, when you look at the logic of employers continuing to focus in on their health insurance instead of focusing on their core business, it really is a problem, I think.
I have, before we take more questions, I just have one comment on the issue of the erosion of health care benefits, and I think that represents an enormous opportunity for people who see, who have the vision for total employee health, to educate the HR benefits people who have a stranglehold on the healthcare benefits model in particular companies. And so the companies that are able to break through and actually be effective at taking a more holistic approach to employee health have sucked those HR and benefits managers into the discussion and educated them about the false economy of, I mentioned briefly in my talk, demand management. You know, demand management sometimes means, you know, you cut the demand because you make it so expensive to go to the doctor, you make copays so high, or you eliminate health insurance altogether. Well, that's one rather dark view of demand management. So you have to bring those HR and health and safety people into the discussion and show them the actual bottom line benefit of taking total care of the employee. Are there any HR benefits people in this office? I mean, in this room? I mean, not too many come to a public health conference. But that's where I see the opportunity. Until we get to the vision that Bill has, which is mine as well, where there's health care for all. So it's an interim stop.
I'm not sure what the question is exactly. Any approaches to getting the employer to
that's
obviously the activities that we're carrying out. We hope will have that influence in this particular workplace or chain. And then, of course, the question is the research to practice translation. How do you make that into a program that has staying power and that isn't just dependent on research study resources to make it effective? So that's
working to identify the what we're calling the essential elements of effective workplace programs, policies, and practices, and we'll make a really concerted effort at identifying what we think works based on decent science, what seems promising based on well-communicated practice, try and link in resources and communicate that widely in order to be able to motivate change in this direction. Correct?
So since traditional health is already significantly under-resourced, both in the research and practice perspective, the amount of morbidity is caused by individuals. So how do we go forward with the consideration without having unanticipated consequences if we're taking resources away from where those are being
instead of this integrated approach, then it does rapidly move towards victim blaming. With respect to the resources, I actually see this as a way out of the darkness. I think that we can leverage the resources that are currently being misspent on ineffective, individually focused work and move them towards more effective programs to support worker health that are integrated and broader in their approach.
I think though that the issue is it's also, I think, getting to your point, David, is the disparities issue as well. So it's not just do smokers know that they should be quitting? Yes, they do, and we actually see in pretty consistent data that interest in quitting and attempts to quit are actually comparable regardless of type of occupation. It's the sort of success with quitting where we run into the issue. So I don't think it's, I think what you're getting at is what is the value added? And I think that's an empirical question that really could actually drive some of our future research, and it really says, kind of along the lines of I think what Greg was saying, well, this is where we need to be headed in terms of understanding what can push this forward, what are the drivers in terms of the business case that we need to make.
And one last comment, that I think the data is actually increasingly good, in part out of Gloria's group, that people who live in chaotic, dangerous communities, as well as engage in dangerous work, are less likely to engage in what appear to be healthier behaviors. As somebody said about environmentalism, you don't ask somebody in my really dangerous community to worry about the ice cap melting, that people choose their priorities based upon what their life experience is.
Thank you very much.